Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. Montana's Supreme Court is comprised of seven justices and rules on a wide range of issues, including the Montana State Constitution. This year, two candidates are running for the seat now held by Mike Wheat, the incumbent, and attorney Lawrence Van Dyke. Mr. Van Dyke has declined to appear on Home Ground, a first for a Supreme Court candidate. At the end of the program, I'll offer some thoughts. Justice Mike Wheat, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thanks, Brian. Glad to be here.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
The first part of my life I spent in Superior, Montana. My dad worked in the woods, sawmill, and was a custodian at the local school there. I finished fourth grade in Superior, and then my folks moved to Henderson, Nevada, where my dad worked in a mine and then worked at the test site. He was in the operating engineers while working at the test site. In 1971, I helped my folks move back to Montana. My dad was born on a homestead outside of Ekalaka, so he's a lifelong Montana guy. And they settled in the Whitehall area. And he then worked until he retired at the Golden Sunlight Mine.
Looking back on that period of your life before you went away to college, what one or two core values did you learn that still stick with you that matter?
Well, my dad, being a blue-collar worker, he always instilled in me, when you work, if you're going to take on a job, make sure you do it right. And if you're going to work, work hard. Don't slough. And so I think those are probably a couple of the core values I learned from my dad.
Where'd you go to law school, and what kind of law did you practice when you got out?
I went to law school at the University of Montana. And when I graduated in 1978, my wife and I moved to Butte, where I was a prosecutor for 3 years. I prosecuted everything from driving offenses to deliberate homicide cases. In 1981, my wife and I moved to Bozeman, where I worked for about 6 months with a private firm there. And there was a fellow in that firm who I went to law school with, and then he and I struck out, hung our own shingle, and started practicing law. Early on, we had a general practice. We were doing anything and everything. As you probably know, being a lawyer yourself, when you hang the shingle, you got to make a little bit of money, and so you're hoping for clients to come through the door. And that firm is still going in Bozeman. But over time, our practice evolved into more of a trial practice where we represented injured people, small businesses, that sort of thing.
You were appointed in 2010 to the Supreme Court by Governor Schweitzer. Why did you seek the appointment?
Early on in my career, I never thought it would be possible that I'd be on the Montana Supreme Court. But then in 2002, I ran for and was elected to the Montana Senate. And I served two sessions in the Senate. And after that, I went back to private practice, but the opening occurred on the Supreme Court, and I had a number of lawyers approach me and ask me to give it consideration. And after a while, I thought this would be a good way to top off a long career in the law. And since I've been on the court, I've enjoyed it very much. It's a very, very rewarding experience.
Why?
Because you're involved in people's lives. People ask me about the cases I work on and how do I stay focused. And what I remind them is that behind every case is a human story of some kind or another. It can be tragic. It can be anything, whether it's a criminal case, whether it's a civil case, whether it's a divorce action. The decisions we make have an impact on people's lives, not just the immediate people, but other people who may get caught up in the litigation process. And so I feel like I'm helping society in the decisions that I help make. And I think it's important for your listeners to remember that I don't make these decisions by myself. It's a collective decision-making process on the court. But I do personally feel like I am giving something back to a society that's been so rewarding to me.
I neglected to mention that given the constitutional process in Montana, correct me if I'm wrong, if you're appointed by the governor as opposed to elected originally, you stand for a confirmation vote of the people, which took place in 2011 in your case, correct?
That's right. Governor Schweitzer appointed me in December of 2010. I was sworn in on the court in early January, and then the next November I was on the ballot to be confirmed by the electorate.
How would you describe your judicial philosophy?
Well, I think every judge's judicial philosophy is shaped and molded by their experiences in life. And mine has been shaped and molded by, as I mentioned earlier, growing up in a family where my father worked construction, worked in the mines, worked hard. When I graduated from high school, I was in the Marine Corps, and I went to Vietnam where I was a combat soldier. And then, of course, I've been married, actually celebrated my 41st wedding anniversary this summer, and my wife and I raised three boys. So through that process, and others, of course, but you learn things about people and about life, and you learn values on how you treat other people and what's right and what's wrong. And those are the kind of values that I think I bring to the court and are important in making decisions that impact other people's lives.
Interesting response, because my question was judicial philosophy, and everything you talked about, I would say, was human values, human experience, the clear implication being to me as a listener that those experiences shape in some way the way things that come before you, before the court. Now, I want to contrast that with a statement by Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice Roberts, who says, "We're umpires, we call balls and strikes." Those are two, my sense would be, different answers. He's basically arguing that his personal experience in life has nothing. Umpires can have different experiences in life, but a ball's a ball and a strike's a strike. What would you say about that?
Well, it can be a ball to one umpire and it can be a strike to another.
I noticed there are a lot of split decisions on your court and the U.S. Supreme Court.
And maybe I should say that there's two aspects to judicial philosophy. And there's the human aspect that we've already described. But that doesn't mean I just get to go up there, sit on the court and make decisions that I think are right and wrong. I'm certainly guided by statutes, case law, constitution, those sorts of legal principles and documents, and guided quite a bit. But in the process of that guiding, I think it's important that judges recognize that they have a history, that they have experiences in life that help guide them in interpreting the law.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Montana Supreme Court Justice Mike Wheat, who is running for re-election to the court. The terms judicial activism and legislating from the bench are used in discussions of appeals courts, usually by critics of the courts. What do those phrases mean to you, judicial activism and legislating from the bench?
It means that, from my perspective, a judge ignores what the law is, whether it's statutory law or constitutional law, and they make decisions that go beyond what the Constitution or the statutes require.
In terms of either let's start with the Montana Court or the U.S. Supreme Court, are there any cases that come to your mind where you'd say the court either exhibited judicial activism or legislated from the bench?
Well, I think there's a difference between judicial activism and legislating from the bench. I think one case that I think demonstrates judicial activism from my perspective on behalf of the United States Supreme Court is the Citizens United case. And I'm probably drawn to that because of the case that our court was involved in, a case called Western Traditions, that relied upon the Citizens United case. And as you already know, that's a case that involved corporate campaign contributions. And Citizens United basically overturned a long-standing law that was passed by Citizen Initiative in Montana that controlled and regulated corporate spending. The district court in Montana overturned that law. Our court, on a split decision, 5-2, reinstated it, and then it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and they, of course, reversed us.
Striking down the restrictions on corporate giving.
Right. I've listened to the U.S. Supreme Court talk about original intent and narrowed decision-making, and I thought that the Citizens United decision was a little broad.
And are you being tactful when you say a little broad?
Well, I think I wouldn't say I'm being tactful. I think it was a little broad because in the Citizens United case, they were talking about a federal law and federal elections, and so then it rolled down to the states. And so the impact is being felt locally, where I happen to think that we ought to have the right to impose reasonable regulations in our elections and on corporate giving.
I'm going to ask you about some specific cases where the allegation has been made or supported or opposed that it represented judicial activism or legislating from the bench. Roe v. Wade, as you obviously know, a 1973 Supreme Court case which established a constitutional right of privacy for pregnant women and established timelines affecting the balance between the woman's privacy rights and the state's rights to regulate termination of pregnancy based on its interest in the life of the fetus. First question, do you think that case represented judicial activism or legislating from the bench?
I think in Roe versus Wade, what the United States Supreme Court was doing was balancing the intrusion by the state into a person's life. And a judge is called upon to do that in instances where legislatures legislate and it intrudes into people's private lives, and that's where the courts, that's their job, are to draw those lines. And I wouldn't call Roe versus Wade a case of judicial activism. I think it's more a case where the court was simply trying to draw some kind of line to define how far the government could intrude into a person's private life.
Do you consider it settled law?
No, I don't consider it settled law, and I think it's subject to change, and it's going to depend on facts of a case that come before the Supreme Court, and that a Supreme Court in the future may overturn it.
And one more, United States Supreme Court case Caperton v. Massey. This case established a new constitutional standard superseding state law, establishing that the Due Process Clause required mandatory recusal of a judge who had received major campaign contributions from one party to a lawsuit that ended up before his court, $3.5 million in that particular case. Would you consider that legislating from the bench or judicial activism?
No, I'm familiar with the Caperton case. It's a case where the Supreme Court had to step in a case where there was a clear conflict of interest. And people who bring cases before courts need to feel that the judges who are hearing their cases are impartial and that they're not going to make their decision based on whether somebody has contributed, I think in the Caperton case, like $5 million.
It was $3.5 million.
Okay, $3.5 million towards their campaign.
That particular case highlights an emerging reality of election campaigns for judges, including state Supreme Court justices, the race, for example, that you're in. Former Montana Chief Justice Carla Gray has publicly stated her concern that Supreme Court elections pose a fundamental risk to judicial independence and political neutrality, and has made some proposals to change the way we appoint or elect Supreme Court justices. Do you feel elections pose a serious risk to judicial independence and integrity?
If there's too much money involved, I do. And if you don't know where the money's coming from, I do. When I was in the legislature, there was a bill to publicly fund judicial elections, and it went nowhere. I understand there's a balance between appointing judges through a process where they're selected by a committee and submitted to a governor or some other appointing body, much like we do in Montana, like I was first appointed to the court, and elections where the judges go out and they actually meet with people. But in the election process, because there's so much money pouring into the process anymore, it's getting thrown out of whack. And I think something's going to have to be done somewhere down the road. Let me give you an example. In the state of Tennessee, just recently, there the Supreme Court justices are appointed, but they have to stand for retention elections. That is, mm-hmm. the people get to vote to either retain them or throw them out of office. The election was just this last August, and there were three of these justices up for election. And there was a lot of money that came into the race from outside of the state. The judges had to go out between the three of them. I think they raised over $1 million to defend their seat. And in the past, they hadn't had to do any of that. Now, I think the voting public has a right to know who's on the Supreme Court and what are their judicial philosophies and what bases can they turn to discover whether they want to vote for those people or not. But the problem with money is it gets skewed, especially since Citizens United, when, I mean, we read almost every day about how much money is pouring into not just judicial races, but our political races. So I think at some point we're going to have to strike a balance. I don't know when that point is, and I don't know if we've reached it in Montana, but I think money in these races can have a very bad influence.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Montana Supreme Court Justice Mike Wheat, who is seeking re-election. We're going to talk about that Tennessee race in a minute. Before we do, let me just make a general comment. In elections for political office, people traditionally give money to candidates who commit to support their political views and their desired legislative outcomes. That would appear, that principle would appear to be in direct conflict with electing judges. You agree or disagree? You understand what I'm saying?
I understand exactly what
you're saying.
I'm buying,
I'm investing in an outcome.
Exactly. Somebody who runs for the legislature, they can say, this is my view on this issue, or this is my view on that issue, and this is how I will vote. It's different with judicial candidates because you can't take a position on issues that may end up in front of you. Because if you do take positions on those issues, the people who bring those issues to the court are going to feel like you're biased one way or the other. And if you are, you shouldn't sit on the case. And so it is different in judicial elections. It's a lot different.
Okay, so let me ask you. You're running in a campaign that's going to cost you money. Do you solicit money for your campaign?
I do.
What do you say to people they're getting for their money?
I encourage people to go look at the cases that I voted on. I encourage them to look at my record as a lawyer. Look at me as a human being, how I've conducted myself. What have I done with my life? What sort of training and experience do I have? I tell people that I was in the Marine Corps where I was in combat, and I learned a lot from that experience. I worked as a carpenter when I was going to school. I was in private practice for 38 years representing individuals and small businesses. I was a prosecutor for 3 years, as I was telling you earlier, raising three boys, being a small businessman in my law practice. Those are all things that I think people can look at and say, well, if I have a case that involves a small business, for example, this person's going to at least have some connection with what it's like being a small business person.
I can't remember the specifics. My understanding is that there was a federal court decision which now allows partisan endorsements of judicial candidates, correct?
Right.
Okay. If I remember correctly, you were a Democratic senator, is that correct?
I was.
Will you be seeking Democratic Party endorsements?
No.
Why?
Because as a sitting justice on the Montana Supreme Court, I don't represent just Democrats. I represent Republicans as well. I represent the entire state of Montana. I don't represent men or women. I represent everybody.
What are you going to do if they endorse you anyway?
I'll ask them to take it away.
Have you received interest group endorsements?
I have. I've been endorsed by MEA-MFT.
And that's a union?
Yes, it's the
Montana Employee.
Montana employees Public Employees and Teachers Union, and I've also been endorsed by AFL-CIO.
Okay, so just in case, just those are political organizations. What's your reaction to those endorsements? Do you tell them, don't endorse me, I'm totally independent?
No, to be honest with you, I'm okay with endorsements from working people, people that are out there working in the organizations that represent them. I just think when we step into the real political arena, it's a little different.
You mentioned the Tennessee race. An August 9th story in the New York Times highlights that result of that race and says that in this case, a, quote, conservative group that's a national organization is looking at a series of states. A victory in Tennessee, this is a quote, would have been a valuable boost, especially as more judicial races loom this year in states like Michigan, Montana, New Mexico, .. This suggests that in this case, a conservative group or groups may target the Montana election. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard rumblings, and I wouldn't be surprised if it happened.
Someone might say it's a free country. People can get involved in any elections they want, and certainly they have the legal right to do so. Do you think that this issue, if it is true, should be of concern to the people of the state of Montana?
Yes, I do. I think Supreme Court justices in Montana ought to be elected by the people in Montana, and the electorate in Montana ought to get their information from people in Montana, not some out-of-state group from New York or Washington, D.C. that wants to pump a bunch of money in here.
Do you personally have any knowledge of the group and whether they will be supporting or opposing you?
I do not.
To be more specific, have you, staff of your campaign, or to your knowledge, people who support you, been in contact with that organization or organizations or people acting on their behalf?
I do not know. I can tell you this. I try very hard not to be involved in any of that. We read every day about the Political Practices Commissioner taking people to task when they coordinate their campaign with some organization like that. So I try very hard not to be involved in that coordination process.
One constitutional issue of central importance is the proper relationship between religion and government, free exercise of religion, separation of church and state. In a 2012 case before the Montana Supreme Court, Big Sky Colony versus Department of Labor, the court ruled on a 4-3 vote that the Hutterite colony in question was required, it voted to sustain the statute enacted by the Montana legislature requiring the colony to participate in workmen's compensation. And we interviewed Justice Beth Baker a few months back about that and some other interesting cases that the Supreme Court decided. You voted with the majority, as did Justice Baker, holding that the Hutterite colony did need to participate in workmen's compensation. And I want to read from the dissent and get your response. Justice Rice made several arguments, but two jumped out at me as a citizen. One, and I'm going to read quotes, "It is first necessary to understand their unique religious principles. The court offers generally that the Hutterite faith is one which, quote, embraces, which, quote, all members agree to live a communal life and follow the teaching and tenets of the Hutterite Church Society. And then further on it says, in terms of the legislative history in question that the court ruled on, HB 119, if I remember correctly, the department proposed HB 119 to address complaints received about, quote, about Hutterite colonies competing with other Montana businesses, such as contractors, without having to provide workers' compensation. The only religious group named in the legislative debates surrounding the legislation were the colonies, etc. Now, the argument that was posed by the dissent was that this was a core principle, non-involvement with government, by the Hutterite communal life, and that the legislation was, in fact, through its legislative history, targeted at that particular church. Just as a citizen and attorney, that struck me as a very powerful argument. Obviously, you saw that differently, and I'd appreciate your reasoning.
Well, it's a case that I don't remember all the details, but my recollection is that the majority in that case focused on the definition of employer and the fact that the colony was engaged in commercial activities where they were competing with other organizations that were not religiously based.
Correct.
They're commercially based. And that was really the basis on which our opinion was based, that they could fit the definition of employer that was in the statutes, and that it wasn't so much of an intrusion into their right to practice their religion that the religious or that the statute couldn't withstand constitutional muster.
Justice Mike Weed, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground.
Thanks, Brian.
As I mentioned at the top of the show, candidate Lawrence Van Dyke has declined to appear on Home Ground. In July, he indicated his schedule was too hectic to make a commitment. In September, he said because he had so much to do, he, quote, can't, end quote, appear. Home Ground Supreme Court candidate interviews go back a decade, and none has ever refused to come on the show. Had Mr. Van Dyke appeared, we would have asked him the same serious questions we asked Justice Wheat about his experience, values, judicial philosophy, and national news reports about out-of-state campaign contributions targeting the Montana Supreme Court race. For some reason, Mr. Van Dyke has chosen to avoid giving answers to our thousands of listeners. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.